Well, yeah. For several decades, identity politics was the widely accepted framework for understanding the relationship between class and oppression on the left. And it contributed to the idea that oppression and class should be severed in terms of their connection, and that Marxist politics was apparently blind in regards to questions of race, sexuality, gender, and so on. However, in recent years, the validity of identity politics has been somewhat challenged. Around the world, the global financial crisis brought class inequality into stark relief, and this has led to a renewed interest in class politics. Even many who have formerly embraced identity politics now question some aspects of those ideas. For instance, David Roediger in the introduction to his recent book on race, class and Marxism. In this context, political theories of oppression that place class as central are becoming more widely accepted. This shift, of course, can't be disentangled from the revival of reformist socialist politics occurring around the world. And hopefully some people have been to this session today, have been to some of the other sessions in the left strategy stream, which gives you more of a sense of this broader phenomena and some of the debates around it, like the rise of the democratic socialists in America, Corbynism in the UK, some of the new left parties in Europe, and so on. Unfortunately, a growing trend within this socialist revival is an economistic approach to questions of oppression. Now, there are various different shades of this economism, and some are definitely worse than others. On the furthest right of this, you have people like Zahra Wachtenstein, the left-wing populist leader in Germany, who argues against immigration refugees on the basis that they hurt working-class living standards and help the far-right grow. Mélenchon and his party in France have a slightly less bombastic version of this, but a similar argument, really, and it's one which is coupled with the embrace of supposedly progressive French nationalism. And in the United States, writers around Jacobin Magazine and the Democratic Socialists of America, for the most part, are critical of the open kind of embrace of anti-immigrant politics, which some of the earlier figures support. However, they put forward an understanding of class and oppression that is still very inadequate and has all sorts of political problems. And it's this last version of contemporary economism that I'm going to be chiefly kind of discussing and critiquing in the session today. Before I get any further in this talk, though, probably it'll be useful to talk about what is economism. This is the start off with to try and answer that. I think part of the difficulty in answering this question is that economism has arisen in very different contexts throughout the history of the socialist movement, and you know, has kind of been applied to different kind of political questions which have arisen. Today, though, the primary way it expresses itself is around the relationship between class and oppression. In attempting to rebut the identity politics arguments, economistic writers put forward a universal vision of class politics that seems to confirm the criticisms that Marxism is class reductionist. This view of oppression puts forward a one-sided, mechanical, and linear view of how working class consciousness develops. What are the intentions of the writers? This ends up downplaying the important divisions that do exist within the working class, and often leads to a dismissive attitude towards political demands or movements of the oppressed, which are considered not to be in the common interests of the working class as a whole. Theoretically, they often adopt an understanding of oppression which oversimplifies its complex reality into a rigid and highly reductionist class-based account, you know, so-called. And this is buttressed by an obsessive focus with how populist left-wing electoral work can unite the working class. And so this economistic approach is very much intertwined with the broader problems of reformist politics. To begin to unpack all of that, though, I want to start by talking about this more broadly, the relationship between class and oppression, and yeah, some of the kind of differences between an economistic approach and what I think a revolutionary approach should be. So the working class is the only force in society which can unite the exploited and oppressed in a common struggle against the capitalist system. It's the only class which has both the interest in abolishing all oppression and exploitation and the means to make this a reality. However, the unity of the exploited and oppressed is, for someone else to reappropriate a quote from Brecht, a simple thing so hard to achieve in reality. For while the working class has the potential to overcome the divisive and oppressive ideas which seek to divide and conquer it, this is only a potentiality. It's not an inevitability. It's not something which will just organically, spontaneously happen. And this is the case for a few reasons. First of all, there is a distinction you have to draw between class consciousness and the kind of objective position of the working class in society. So the working class always has you know, the potential power to overthrow society on one level. That they're the ones who do all the work in society. They're the ones whose exploitation all society rests on. They have this key strategic possibility. But that can often be, and pretty much always is, very different to what the actual consciousness of the working class is. How they actually understand their position in society, how much they accept and reject capitalism, how much confidence they have in their own abilities, and all the kind of questions which flow from that. Alongside that, there's also huge unevenness within the working class itself. So it's not just like there's one section who kind of understand everything, are very militant, others who are really right-wing, and people in between. There's huge contradictions within that, different tensions. People understand some aspects of society, but not others. Some people are militant on some issues, and not on others as well. And unevenness is, you know, throughout the working class all around the world. Another aspect which is important to see is that while struggle is obviously absolutely important in terms of giving people some confidence in their own power to transform society and can open up the possibility to break down these ideas, there's nothing automatic about that. And often people don't just generalise out from their immediate direct experiences of struggle a whole theory about the world and how they understand all of oppression, even if they are able to break with some ideas based on their experiences. I've got some time, it looks like. But like a personal example of this, for instance, is my uncle Johnny, who's a bus driver. He is he's a very like militant guy. He's been involved in the trade union for many, many years. One of the earliest stories I remember him telling me is when Gough Whitlam was sacked in the 70s, he was driving a bus at the time, and it came over the radio they'd been sacked, and he just turned off the bus and told all the passengers to get out of the bus and said, "Oh, going on strike now. Gough Whitlam's been sacked." And he just drove the bus to Hyde Park. He's like, "Oh, it'll be a rally somewhere in the city, so I'll just drive around until I find it." So quite a left-wing guy in that kind of sense. I also remember going to the pub with him once on his birthday, and some people at the table next to us are talking about Vietnamese people, saying some pretty horrible racist stuff about them. And he got up, he's 65 years old or something, and had this huge go at them and shoved one of them to the floor. and this huge argument with them about it. And, as I was talking to him about it afterwards, he was talking about how Posey was the Vietnam War, how that kind of shaped him, but also how there was a lot of Vietnamese people who worked on the buses with him, and they were involved in this strike in the 80s together. So that's all positive stuff. As we started talking and drinking and whatnot, he went on to explain a lot of his other views about the world, including how he does not like Chinese people or Japanese people or basically all other Asian people except for Vietnamese people. His views that women have too many rights these days compared to when he was younger, how gay people have taken over the world, etc. So lots of contradictory ideas that people have. And that's just a little kind of funny example, whatever. But the point more generally is that people have all sorts of contradictory ideas which they pick up from struggle, from their experiences in society, but often they're not generalised out into a coherent kind of theory about how society works. Another point I want to make just before I go back to talk about The Economist in more detail, it's been a bit of a detour, is just that politics and how people understand political ideas doesn't necessarily come from the workplace, which is an important point, I think, that many socialist writers have talked about. That example about Michael Johnny, for instance, one of the main reasons why he supported Vietnamese people was partly because he worked with them, but also just with the Vietnam War and kind of things about that. And he never went to one of the rallies. It was just the general kind of sentiment around it, arguments that they, had something that they were standing up for. But more generally, they can be this bit of a schema, which is that, workers go into struggle and then eventually they come up against the state, and then that forces them to think about political questions. And that definitely can be true and is one of the dynamics which goes on. But often, kind of questions around politics and oppression interact with the working class in different ways, because workers also just live in society more generally. And so they come into interaction with it in a whole series of different ways. Lenin writes about this quite a bit in What Is To Be Done, which is his polemic against economists from a very long time ago, but there's some striking parallels. One of the points he makes about that is that lots of workers first kind of come into contact with politics in a range of different ways. They can see that there's a rebellion of peasants, or there's a new law which is passed banning a national minority, or there's demonstrations by students, a whole series of different things which forces them to think about the world in more detail. So what all this points to, I think, is that rather than kind of the working class overcoming oppression in this really automatic, kind of linear, mechanical way, instead it's a very dynamic process where there's a relationship between struggle, but also between political intervention. which is really vital, that you actually have to have people going there and making arguments to people about how their experiences expose something more fundamental about the world. And Lenin has a good quote from What Is To Be Done about this. He writes, "In order to become a Marxist, the worker must have a clear picture in his mind of the economic nature and social and political features of the landlord, the priest, the high state official and the peasant, the student and the vagabond. He must know their strong and weak points. He must grasp the meaning of all the catchwords by which each class and each stratum camouflages its selfish strivings and its real inner workings. He must understand what interests are reflected by certain institutions and certain laws and how they are reflected. But this clear picture cannot be attained from any book. It can be obtained only from the living examples and from exposures that follow close upon what is going on about us at any given moment, upon what is being discussed and whispers perhaps, each one in his own way, upon what finds expression such and such events. These comprehensive political exposures are an essential and fundamental condition for training the masses in revolutionary activity." Awesome, thanks. Sorry. And political invention, as I said, is key, and I'll come back to that in the conclusion. Back to the debate with the economists, though, because what does all this mean for them? Now, most economistic writers would accept, at least theoretically, like a lot of what I said in regards to the differences within the working class, there needs to be struggle some way in order to break them out of that, etc. However, they put forward inadequate solutions and strategies to overcome this, which reveals that I don't think they actually grasp the seriousness of the problem. And I'm going to go through a few examples of some of the more recent debates around this to give you an idea of what they say and kind of the logic of the argument and I think some of the problems of it. The first example is a debate which arose when this book came out by this writer, Hayder. He wrote this book called Mistaken Identity, Race, Class in the Age of Trump, which came out at the end of last year, I think. This kicked off a debate in a bunch of left-wing journals, particularly in Jacobin magazine, but in a few others as well, about what is the relationship between class and race, particularly in America. Now, a lot of criticisms were raised of Hayder's book, and at least some of them are kind of partially true. However, what is more interesting, I think, in terms of understanding economism today, rather than Hayder's book itself, is the political content of the responses and alternatives put forward. So Melissa Nashek, for instance, who reviewed the book in Jacobin, argued that instead of class-based action, Hayder suggests that activists can nurture their own issues and become one mass movement through osmosis. In contrast, working-class coalitions are built by workers who join together on the basis of their shared exploitation, not separate interests that agree in the abstract to anti-capitalism. And she goes on to argue that Hayder is wrong to maintain that socialism and black self-determination are mutually dependent political projects. Alternatively, she argues that we need a class-based universal strategy, which is kind of the catch cry, and that's capable of amassing a powerful enough force in society, not just to articulate demands, but to enact them. And she argues that such a strategy should be based on a series of pretty relative modest reforms of affordable healthcare, a livable planet, quality education, and respect and security in the workplace, and that this strategy is embodied in the Bernie Sanders electoral campaign. Now, putting aside, as I said before, whatever weaknesses Hayder's that might be in Hayder's book, if people want to talk about it in the discussion, we can. One level, it's a bit irrelevant in terms of understanding this kind of debate. Let's just talk about what's wrong with this response. First of all, the idea that black self-determination, socialism, are opposed political principles is a pretty sharp break with the whole history of the socialist movement and what we have argued. Both revolutionary socialists, but also most reformist socialists, at least in words, have argued the exact opposite to that. They've argued that the struggle for socialism, the struggle for black self-determination are interlinked struggles, and in fact that only socialism would be able to guarantee real black self-determination rather than what you can have under capitalism, which is always going to be undermined by the problems of exploitation and racism, which is inherent to the system. This counterposition between working class struggle and the struggle against oppression is also obvious in the previous thing I quoted before, which can sound fine on one level, but when you unpack it, I think it's quite problematic. When she wrote, "Working class coalitions are built by workers who join together on the basis of their shared exploitation." So that's true. But then she says, "but not on separate interests that agree in the abstract anti-capitalism." And what she means by separate interests are the interests of oppressed groups and the demands they put forward. So she's saying you can't unite on that basis because it's abstractly about anti-capitalism. And this is just accepting the idea, really, that the demands put forward by oppressed groups are being generated by some separate interests that apparently either they do not share or are somehow counterposed to the interests of the working class as a whole, as acceptance of a pretty right-wing argument. Now, economistic writers like Millicent and Racina argue this elsewhere, would defend themselves from this charge by arguing that they don't ignore questions of oppression, but they see their solution in economic class struggle as the way forward, and they see the raising these other demands as a distraction from the way in which we're going to advance these struggles. Now, obviously, class struggle on economic level, trading activity, strikes, etc., can play a really important role, giving workers a sense of their own power and opening up greater possibilities to break down divisive ideas, etc. However, as I said before, there's nothing automatic about this. And this is particularly the case when the economic struggle they're talking about is often pretty moderate, reformist campaigns around, like, Medicare for All, for instance, which I'll talk about in a bit. There was a good kind of point made about this in a recent article in Left Voice by a number of kind of Marxist academics in the United States. They argue, racism is not just a set of illusions or ideas that will simply evaporate when economic conditions change. On the contrary, it exists as a complex of practical and institutional state and non-state forms of subjection, coercion, and violence. Neither police bullets, nor ICE detention centres, nor the extra-legal forms of violent white supremacy can be made to disappear simply by winning wage increases and higher levels of unionisation. I think that's definitely the case. Like, that's not to dismiss fighting for better wages or unionism, but that is not going to just be able to overturn the legacy and reality of racism in the United States today. A concrete example of how this kind of position plays out has really been drawn out in the recent debate about black reparations in the United States. For those who haven't been following it, this is a kind of debate which was primarily started initially by a number of like kind of liberal middle-class intellectuals who raised the idea that there should be reparations for the black population because of the history of slavery, but also the ongoing legacy of racism. And there's all sorts of debates about exactly how you would, what the mechanism would be by which you would allow this reparations to happen between kind of different theorists. So it would be like a cash payment to individuals, or funding for particular services or community groups, and what ones there would be, how you determine it, etc. But that is the, you know, the main kind of idea behind the project. Most of the kind of economistic writers are either really critical or outright hostile to this demand being put forward whatsoever. So Bashkar Sankara, for instance, has written a series of articles, some in Jacobin, but mainly in The Guardian, the newspaper, about why this is a distraction from the key issues of fighting for socialism and economic justice in the United States. And one of the key arguments he makes is that while it's not true that reparations would privilege black workers over white workers, that's like a false idea, he says they would appear to be this way to many white workers. And this would give ammunition to the right wing in society to attack the left and drive a wedge between black and white workers. Now, there's a lot which is wrong with this. The first thing is, if you just put aside black reparations for a second, if you apply this logic to just oppression in general, you would have to disclude tons of like demands which are put forward. There's lots of demands thought of by non-oppressed sections of the working class as somehow being a privilege to oppress people. Like, tons of people, think it's very right-wing and terrible that Aboriginal people get these magical benefits that apparently exist in terms of money and stuff for them, which other people don't get because they're from an oppressed group. Or people think that about women, or LGBTI people, and people often think about black people as well. If you apply to some of the campaigns we fight for instance, like the refugees, if we're able to actually get the refugees off Manus and Nauru and bring them to Australia, you would not just leave it there. You would argue they should get housing, healthcare, education, a whole series of things. And I'm sure the right wing in society would make an argument to say, these people are getting privileges off the back of all your ordinary Australians, don't you know? This is really terrible. The response of socialists to that should not be to capitulate to the right wing campaign. It has to be to convince people to support oppressed people winning their demands and not just to fall for whatever ideological campaign the right wants to wage against them. It's also really important, I think, because the only way you can really show to oppressed people about why they should unite with the rest of the population in common struggle is by taking their demand seriously and having some sensitivity towards it, not just dismissing it because it might be hard to convince other people to take a stand around it. The black reparations debate is also linked into a broader kind of debate which is going on in the American left, which I don't have tons of time to talk about, but I'll just flag, which is about like the civil rights movement and black power and its relationship to that. So people probably have seen there's been a lot of articles in Jacobin magazine really slamming like the Black Panther Party, black power, etc., in a pretty over-the-top way. Like, there's all sorts of limitations you can point out to that movement, but their argument basically is that that whole development was a negative step backwards compared to the civil rights movement of early years, because that represented a broad kind of coalition of whites and blacks together, whereas black power was a totally separatist movement that was negative to the development of kind of common struggle. And as I said, obviously there were, you know, limitations and contradictions within that, but I think that's a really one-sided understanding of how, you know, class and oppression interact. Now, these arguments are often also backed up by broader theoretical arguments, which I'm not going to go through all tons of detail today, but if people want to check them out more, Sarah has a very good article in the Marxist Left Review talking about these kind of issues. Some of the main themes they raise, though, I'll talk about a bit. Like, one is there's a whole argument about what's called anti-essentialism, which is the idea that, you know, which is correct at one level, that obviously race and all these identities are socially constructed under, you know, class society. They're not just naturally historical givens. They're shaped, reshaped again and again. However, they take this too far to an extreme, which basically says, well, because they're historically created, therefore they're kind of fake. And they're not real identities which you have to deal with, and they don't really have a concrete material basis, and so they should be ignored compared to material, you know, identities which do matter, like the working class, which is a kind of overreaction to that, and doesn't understand how something can be socially constructed, but that doesn't mean it's not real in the sense that you have to actually respond to it, or that oppression shapes people's identity in a very real way, obviously, which they have to deal with. Another, probably the most extreme example of this is a theorist people might have heard of called Adolf Reed, who's written a whole series of articles about race and class in America, which in my opinion are pretty appalling. He wrote an article about Hurricane Katrina, which is somewhat notorious, where he argues that the fact that they were black, you know, mainly black people who suffered under that, is irrelevant. If they're all white, they would have been treated exactly the same by the United States government, because this is about class. That is what happened there. It wasn't about race whatsoever. He also makes an argument about mass incarceration in the United States, where he says that, again, it has nothing to do with race, it's about class. There's evidence for this, which is pretty appalling, this is also something raised by right-wingers about it, is that there's more white people in prison than black people in America, so therefore it's about class, not about race. This, people probably obviously know the answer to that, which is black people are a small percentage of the population than white people, so in fact there's more white people, doesn't tell you anything. There's more white people in prison in Australia than Aboriginal people, presumably, but Aboriginal people are a very small part of the population, that's the point, it's about the disproportion. Amount between, you know, what they make up of, you know, the prison population overall. Cool. Well, yeah, but if you want to explore that more in the discussion, definitely can. As I was saying earlier, all of this is very much linked to broader political problems. And Melissa Nashek's kind of argument in Jacobin really shows that, that her alternative she puts forward, she says it's this universal class kind of movement. In reality, it's a reformist electoral movement around Bernie Sanders. So against black reparations, the usual alternative argument that's put is that you should campaign for Medicare for All, because everyone benefits from that, rather than just a section of people benefiting from black reparations. And there's a real focus on parliamentary elections as a key kind of battlefield. I think this is important in terms of understanding what's wrong with economism, because it's not just... The problem is not like all these people just read the wrong books or like are stupid or something and don't understand the relationship between oppression and class. It flows from their acceptance of reformism more generally, and particularly this kind of electoral form, which currently people are quite obsessed over. And this, I think, has huge right-wing pressures on people in regards to oppression in a number of ways. First of all, there's an obsession with the idea that, well, you have to form government, which means getting 50 plus 1% of the vote, and in a situation where there isn't a huge radicalization where millions of people are, you know, turning towards a revolution or whatever, that means winning over a lot of pretty backward and conservative voters in order to support you. And that puts a huge right-wing pressure on the political project you put forward, which I think is very clear in the black reparations stuff. They're constantly worried about what are, you know, tens of millions of people going to think about this demand if we put it forward, if not a majority of people agree with us and we can't put it forward, because that would be, you know, too hard, too difficult to push forward the electoral project overall, and it'll help to undermine that project going forward. But also the orientation towards elections puts a right-wing pressure on people in a different way, which is the pressure from the middle class, from the capitalists, from the media, from the state, etc. Because on one level, they do know if they succeed, they're going to have to be overseeing the state, which is going to, you know, maybe be less racist than another party was running it. But fundamentally, it's still going to be racist and doing a whole series of horrible things. I think that helps to explain why, and you know, different people have different levels of this, but the people who are close to the heart of the reformist projects are much more cynical about these kind of arguments. And I think it's much more of them just trying to find a left-wing socialist reason for why they have to support border controls or anti-immigration arguments, or why they have to reject demands put forward by the oppressed. It's one of the reasons why, in many ways, this debate is the most developed in Europe, because there the kind of reformist left are closer to political power, you know, to being on the country. You know, Die Linke in Germany are involved, have been involved in various coalition things, but MS is a more kind of serious force, etc. And you can see, like, in the UK, it's coming up more and more, obviously, around Corbynism and the debates about freedom of movement and Brexit. And that's, you know, expression of him being, you know, possibly closer to power as well. Cool. Well, what is the alternative to all of this then? As I was saying before, winning the unity of the oppressed and exploited is not an easy task, but definitely an absolutely necessary one. And I think it has to be from the standpoint of a revolutionary project which combines supporting the particular demands of the oppressed with the general demands of the working class, rather than seeing them as counterposed to each other. And people, you know, I wasn't going to read that whole quote, obviously, but people probably know the famous quote from Lenin about the Tribune of the People. I think that is definitely the spirit which socialists should take to these movements against oppression. I think this is very different to, and just because it relates to some of the readings I know people did for the session, to the kind of argument put forward by Hayder, but also by people like Judith Butler, which is the more left-wing identity politics kind of argument, where they argue for a strategy of an alliance between different kind of autonomous oppressed movements who should work together, and it's a reaction to the most kind of negative versions of identity politics that just want to counterpose everyone's oppression to each other. They're trying to kind of break around that. But the problem with it, I think, is it ignores the specific importance of the working class within any kind of such alliance and its power, and they never talk about that. They just talk about there's all these oppressed groups, they're oppressed by capitalism, so therefore they should unite. That's, you know, a step forward compared to some of the other arguments. We have to go beyond that to start to talk about the particular power the working class has and the need for, you know, socialist politics in particular. So in summary, I think we need a movement which, as I was saying before, combines the demands of the oppressed with a universal, if you will, program of working class self-emancipation, and that points towards a revolutionary confrontation with the capitalist state as replacement with a society based on workers' power, one that could actually guarantee that both the oppressed and the exploited are treated with dignity and they have real control and power over their lives. And a few, just, I do have a bit of time, just a few historical kind of vignettes, I think, show this out and kind of show what's so wrong with the economists' kind of position. So, first of all, if the economists were right, then that, you know, kind of universal class programs overrides the kind of particular interests of the oppressed and they become the central focus of things, then the huge revolutionary explosions in like 1905 and 1917, for instance, should have seen everyone abandon their particular demands about oppression and just support the universal class demands putting forward. If people know anything about that, that is the opposite of what happened. In fact, there was an explosion of demands by the oppressed, and a whole series of different oppressed groups. Probably most predominantly were the various national minorities throughout Russia, because Russia was an empire at the time, who, you know, didn't say, oh, well, now, you know, that there's this challenge to Russia, we're just going to just support the workers' government. They started to raise demands about their own independence, their own struggle against the history of, you know, greater Russian nationalism and chauvinism. And the response of socialists to that, of revolutionary socialists anyway, was to say, well, we need to unite with those struggles. We can't just say to them, oh, don't fight for your independence, just support the socialist struggle which we're arguing for and put all your kind of demands into the future. Instead, they argued that they had to be combined together. Similarly, in the 60s and 70s, there was a whole series of political movements for the oppressed, which helped actually to politicise society and break down the conservative political period of the 1950s and the kind of McCarthyist Cold War era, which definitely did help you know, to encourage the re-emergence of working class struggle in the kind of later 60s and 70s when that came onto the table. And obviously there are always tensions within that, political debates between, you know, separatists and other forces about what's the way forward around class and oppression, but you can't just ignore that dynamic, I think. And even though today there's obviously a much lower level of struggle compared to what there was in the past in a series of ways, still, if you're looking for it, you can see those dynamics still at work. Just recently, for instance, in Europe, in response to the kind of GFC in particular and the kind of crisis in neoliberalism going on there, there's been a revival of various independence movements, probably most predominantly Catalonia in Spain. And there was a huge debate in response to that because a lot of the left did clearly have an economistic approach where they just said, well, this is counterposed the interests of working class as a whole. They looked at the most kind of right-wing arguments being put forward by for Catalonian independence by kind of bourgeois forces there and said, oh, therefore, you know, you have to dismiss this kind of movement. And it was very much linked to the broader debates about reformism, was one of the main reasons why people were critical or at least passive around Catalonia on the left, was because they could see that it would hurt the electoral chances of Podemos and its kind of strategy going forward. And it raised all these thorny questions, which, you know, Podemos definitely were not going to answer in a very principled way. And so people had to come up with these kind of apologies and reasons to avoid that question, push it into the background, rather than seeing, well, this is another struggle which is breaking up, hopefully, or could break up the conservatism of the situation and did open up important mass struggles, and that socialists should be about encouraging them, pushing them forward. Well, just to draw it all to a conclusion, one question which is often raised in regards to this debate is, like, doesn't matter that much because, you know, the economists are wrong about a bunch of things, but they're, like, for class politics, and that is a useful step forward compared to identity politics dominating everything in the past. But I think it does really matter because it's both about what kind of left you try to construct for the future. When there are big radical struggles, your positions about class and oppression will matter a lot because they'll shape how you relate to those movements in a very serious way. But also it's about what kind of left you're trying to build today, about what are the arguments you're trying to convince people of. And as we've seen, the question of oppression is definitely not going anywhere. Like, all around the world, this question comes up, whether it's the border camps in the United States, or it's the condition of African Americans, the US, or if it's Aboriginal people here, whether it's women's rights, LGBTI rights, etc. It continues to come up because of the exploitative and horrible situation of capitalism. So we have to be able to respond to that in a principled and clear way, which pushes things towards, you know, a united struggle against the system, which doesn't counterpose that to the struggles of the oppressed and exploited for their rights. So we have to see those things as directly interconnected and a part of the struggle against capitalism. Okay.